in addition to any fructose sources you may be taking in, you still need something like a potato-based source or a bread-based source to satisfy the muscle glycogen needs. Okay. Because the muscle lacks the enzyme necessary for using fructose to create storage glycogen. Only the liver has that enzyme. So you have to take care of your muscles too.
Welcome to the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. So together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now, here's your host, Tina Muir.
Hello, this is Tina Muir. Thank you so much for joining me for the latest episode of the Run to the Top podcast, brought to you by Runners Connect. Last week, we talked to Julie Benson, who shared her chilling story about the Boston Marathon bombing and her eating disorder. It was such a powerful episode that if you haven't already gone to check it out, make sure you go back. Today, we're going to be talking to one of the top 100 most influential individuals in health and fitness, Ben Greenfield. Ben is the founder and owner of Greenfield Fitness Systems, which develops innovative and cutting-edge fitness and nutrition services and solutions. We're going to talk a lot about this today and how you can determine which nutritional and training program will work best for you as an individual, despite what others do. Ben's also very knowledgeable in fat burning, which I know a lot of runners are interested in, and he shares his best advice and some interesting findings he found on when we should consume the majority of our carbs, and it's not what you think. But before we hear from Ben, I have an exciting new sponsor to introduce you to. I will explain more about it later in the show, but for now, let's welcome Jabra as our first sponsor of the Run to the Top podcast. Running with music or podcasts distract us when those mental demons are loud, but not when you're tangled in cords. Jabra Pulse is a wireless sports earbud that is perfect for runners of all levels and speed. Visit jabra.com/runnersconnect to enter to win a free Jabra Pulse every month. Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tina.
Thank you for coming on. I mean, I'm very excited about this one. Anyone who's even remotely interested in fitness, triathlons, running, or anything will have heard of you. So this is great for us. But can you kind of share a little about who is Ben Greenfield, maybe the story behind the Superman that we hear about?
What do you want to know?
I guess maybe just kind of your background, maybe a few things that people may not know if they listen to your podcast all the time. Maybe they're in the first few episodes you ever did, or just some little tidbits about your life.
Sure, I'll give you a few fun tidbits since I know this is a running podcast. Mm-hmm. I really didn't do a lot of running at all until basically like late high school. I can't say that I ever ran much more than about a mile. Oh, wow. Up until that point. Played a lot of basketball, played a lot of tennis. I started running hills like back behind my house mm-hmm. to become a better tennis player when I was in high school. When I got into college, though, I started studying exercise physiology and biomechanics and started dating a woman who is now my wife, and she ran cross country and track and field at University of Idaho. So I basically had to kind of like pick up running and learn how to run from her. Yeah, chase her down. So, and I really fell in love with running. I got to a point where I got roped into, and this is at a time when I was bodybuilding. So I was about 210 pounds, right around 3% body fat. And my wife and her brother-in-law roped me into being the runner for their triathlon team. Uh-huh. They put together to do, this was the Coeur d'Alene triathlon. And I had never been to like an endurance event, a triathlon, anything like that. I remember my wife, I stood there watching with a raised eyebrow as she smeared her body down in Crisco to keep her warm during the cold water swim because she didn't own a wetsuit and she had to stay warm somehow. So yeah. She's smearing herself in Crisco. All these people are running around with like pointy helmets and spandex, and I'm just like standing there in my bodybuilding shorts looking completely out of place. I'm just this big old, you know, ripped guy among a bunch of ectomorphic triathletes. And I take off running, and at this point most of my cardio had been like, you know, some like bicycling intervals to shed fat, you know, after lifting weights, and like some elliptical trainer, and pretty much, you know, just like in the gym sucking down a protein shake and and doing like the indoor cardio thing. That was my experience with cardio. And that was like the most painful. This was a 10K. It was an Olympic distance triathlon. That was like the most painful 10K in my life. Like I was used to going to the pain cave and having a bunch of lactic acid build up and having to deal with the rigors of exercise. But I just remember my pecs were so big, like my boobs were bouncing up and down. And I was like, oh, this must be what a woman feels like if she runs without a bra on. And I like my whole lower back was tightening up because my glutes and my erector spinae were so big from like all the deadlifting and the squats. But I really liked it. Like I really dug it across the finish line. I thought, wow, okay. So I kind of get what it feels like, you know, to climb your own personal Mount Everest and go out there and do an endurance event like this. And so I kind of started drinking the Kool-Aid, and for the next 10 years, took a deep, deep dive into the physiology of endurance, the nutrition of endurance. I did about a decade of Ironman triathlons. I did, you know, marathons. I do a lot of obstacle racing now, but specifically to things like, well, not just endurance, but getting big amounts of endurance and performance while still maintaining high levels of health.
Mm-hmm. And would you say, you mentioned about, you know, that was kind of, would you say that was a turning point for you, that 10K? Like, was that part of the reason you kind of wanted to dive into endurance sports a bit more, or were there other things that kind of came together in that?
Well, a big part of it too is like, I'm a fan of trying out all sorts of new things in life, yeah. Right? Like kind of, you know, I've played just about every sport known to man. And, you know, I'd say that maybe a year from now, I won't be doing a lick of endurance, right? Maybe I'll be jumping back into like whatever, master's level tennis, or I'll pick up Frisbee golf, or, you know, who knows. But basically what it comes down to is I'm a fan of experimenting with a lot of different things. However, that was a point where that was one of the first endurance events that I kind of did. And when I realized that, because endurance is a sport of attrition, right? Like there's a great deal of planning. There's a great deal of nutrition and hydration involved. It's different than like baseball in that respect. You know, if you're standing out in the infield in baseball, you're not just going to drop down and bonk and start to cramp randomly while you're standing there.
Well, in most
cases, unless it's a very, very long game.
Yeah.
However, in endurance, like there are so many things that you have to plan for and that you have to have set up, and it's very scientific and it can be very exact. And I found that married quite well to my master's studies in physiology and nutrition and biomechanics. And even when I started opening up my personal training studios and gyms after that, I added high-speed video cameras, you know, to do biomechanical evaluation of run and cycling gait. And I, you know, added blood lactate testing and VO2 max testing, all these things that allowed me to really geek out on endurance athletes, because it is a sport that you can really kind of geek out on, because science helps you go faster. And that really attracts me to that part of you know, chronic repetitive motion sports.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of our listeners will be able to resonate with that, because, you know, a lot of people, runners especially, and I guess triathletes or any endurance sports, are very interested in doing all those little things that, you know, you can try out to see if it helps you get better. And I think that's, you know, a big part of, obviously there's other things that come into it, but people love listening to you and what you have to say, because you try these things and you give, you know, your real opinion on them. So let's kind of look at that a little bit. And then I was just wondering, when it comes to all these different things that you get offered, or you have people coming on your podcast, do you ever have trouble with it, like conflicting kind of things going against each other?
Give me an example.
So, you know, say one person tells you to have to try some kind of powder or shake that's going to help you train faster, train longer, and then someone else tells you you shouldn't be drinking any kind of shakes because they're going to, you know, your fat burning is not going to be as effective if you do it.
Right. That's where it all comes down to, the fact that personalized nutrition and personalized training is highly important. And I'll give you a few examples of that. So you might have one person who has developed a program based on high intensity intervals and weight training and like powerlifting, and they might claim that that is how to train for endurance. And you take Jane Runner and Jill Runner, and you put them both into that program, and Jane Runner flourishes, and Jill Runner gets injured and does not increase her fitness, does not get faster, etc. Now, if we take Jill and Jane and we do like a salivary genetic panel on them, which you can do, you know, you can use like 23andMe, for example, and you can do that for, say, $150. And we would probably find out that the person who responded well to that interval power strength training, they have a higher percentage of fast switch muscle fiber. They have a higher number of endogenous antioxidants produced that allow them to bounce back from inflammatory muscle damage much more quickly. They may be what is called a power responder in terms of the specific genetic markers that respond well as far as increasing mitochondrial density in response to power training versus endurance training. And so that's why they respond better, whereas, you know, Jill, who didn't respond quite as well, should have been doing more like Maffetone or Lydiard style training, you know, longer aerobic efforts and less time doing power and intervals and weight training. Another example would be, let's say, your neighbor across the street who does very, very well on a plant-based diet, right? Whereas you just feel like crap when you are doing kale and spinach and you have this craving for whatever, bacon and grass-fed meat. And a big, big part of that comes to, down to whether or not you are, for example, an under-methylator or an over-methylator, right? Like some people can get high amounts of folic acid and a lot of these methylated vitamins from plants. They're able to absorb those and utilize them quite well. Other people need to have meat in order to be able to produce enough methyl groups to allow for them to have proper metabolism and recovery. And that just comes down to genetics, as does, for example, the lactase persistence gene, right? Your ability to digest lactose and do well with dairy. It's going to vary widely, whether you come from like sub-Saharan African or Eastern Asian or Northern European or Israeli origin. Like they all have different levels of this gene that will persist after you've been a baby that allows you to either digest lactose or not digest it. Another example would be like how much salivary amylase do you have, right? Like a Kenyan marathoner produces a lot of salivary amylase, like that population, like a sub-Saharan African, for example, digests carbs very efficiently. They have a lower insulinogenic response from the pancreas to carbohydrates. And so high amounts of banana, rice, et cetera, produce very few markers of cardiovascular issues, oxidation, metabolic damage, et cetera. Whereas you take like someone from a Northern European population who doesn't produce a lot of salivary amylase, they don't do quite as well with high amounts of rice and potatoes and bread and fruit, et cetera, because their diet would have traditionally been higher in fat, higher in like cured meats, fish, et cetera. And so they're going to do better on higher fat intake. The same could be said for like salt, for example. You take someone from a Northern European population who traditionally would have had a lot of like fish and meat cured with salt and even fermented foods cured with a lot of salt because preservation would have been more important in like the winter season, for example. They develop very good salt excretion mechanisms, right? That salt that you might see crusted on your running shorts after a run, et cetera, you might have a lot of that. And the person you competed against might not. You might have a greater requirement for salt intake during a race, whereas they may not, because you have very, very efficient salt excretion mechanisms, because your body doesn't want to necessarily hold on to all that salt that you've been genetically stored to excrete a little bit better. You know, you take somebody who, say, say their ancestors traveled over on the slave ships from Africa, and there wasn't a lot of salt in situations like that. And those people would have developed very good salt storing mechanisms. And that's why like African Americans who are following a typical Western diet high in salt develop high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease from all that sodium, because they don't excrete it as well as say like someone from Northern European population. And so what I'm getting at here is vegan diet works for some people, doesn't work for other people. Power training works for some people, interval training works for some people, and endurance training works better for other people. And so when it comes down to diets and training plans, it can be confusing. And the reason is different approaches work for different people. I consider my job to be simply connecting people with as many different solutions as possible so that they can go out and then, you know, test and see what works for them and what doesn't. And in some cases, it simply comes down to there being more than one way to skin the cat. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, you know, there's probably 100 different green juices and green powders and green smoothies, for example, out there on the market. Frankly, a lot of them are really good. A lot of them work. And it doesn't come down to you putting all 100 in your fridge and, like, you know, using them all because whatever, I've talked about them all. It's just basically looking at them and noting the subtle differences, right? Like one might be high in ashwagandha, an adaptogenic herb that helps you respond well to stress. So that might be the green powder or the green smoothie or the multivitamin that you choose. Or perhaps you tend to deal with stomach issues. And so you might want to choose a greens powder that has more digestive enzymes and probiotics in it. So again, it all comes down to individuality.
Yeah. And then, so then if that's the case, what for people who, you know, may not be, I don't want to say may not be as interested, but may want to like get this quick fix of like, okay, tell me which one is best to go. Are you saying that, you know, it's pretty difficult for someone to say, okay, this is what's going to work for me, or that here's the right answer? You're saying that, you know, with all these individual differences and different, like for example, the juices you said, like different ingredients that could work better for different people, that, you know, it really becomes a case of finding the, I guess, the recipe that works best for you with all these aspects of your training and life.
Well, yeah, I mean, for example, we live in an era where, you know, the same test that would have cost you $10,000 from like the Princeton Longevity Institute or Duke or, you know, Centergenics or something like that, you can now order blood tests like that, comprehensive blood tests, for under $1,000 from the comfort of your own home. And you can run all your own bloods and figure out, hey, do I need to take vitamin D or do I not need to waste my money on that? Mm-hmm. Or do I have high levels of inflammation because perhaps I need to add in extra antioxidants to support inflammatory damage from my training? Or do I not need to worry about that because my inflammation levels are low? And do I have good omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acid ratios? Or do I not? And should I perhaps lay off the high intake of trail mixes and nut butters I'm consuming and shifts just slightly towards something like, you know, algae and chlorella and spirulina and fish or fish oil. So that's a big part of it. Gut testing is also very inexpensive now. So you can look at your own bacteria, yeast, fungus, like a basic stool analysis and find out what you personally need to be doing from a gut standpoint. Maybe your bacterial balance is perfect. Maybe the bacteria in your gut is a complete wasteland because perhaps you weren't breastfed growing up, or perhaps you don't have a high intake of fermented foods in your diet, and or maybe you went through a couple times in your life when you were on a high amount of antibiotics, and so you might be somebody who needs to replace that bacteria with good probiotics and fermented foods. I talked about the genetic testing, so I don't need to really kick that horse to death, but, you know, blood testing, gut testing, genetic testing, all of those can help you shed light on your individual needs and not only what kind of nutrition or supplementation program is going to work for you, but also what kind of training program is going to work well for you. Probably the last thing that, you know, you should take into account when you look at training, for example, is not just like genetic fast twitch, slow twitch muscle fiber capacity, or whether you're a power responder versus whether you're an endurance responder, but a big part of it too is just your biomechanics, right? Like, not only what is your body type, are you ectomorph, thin, lean? Are you mesomorph, athletic? Are you endomorph, apple-shaped, etc.? Because that's going to affect what kind of training you should do. But also, you know, how do you move? Or like, have you met with a physical therapist or a good local sports chiropractic physician and done, for example, functional movement screen, mm-hmm, to see, you know, how does your overhead squat look? How does your lateral side to side movement look? How does your movement look in a frontal plane, in a sagittal plane? What kind of little things need to be fixed on your body? Because that's going to change based on whether you have like a desk job versus a construction job, based on whether you have naturally tight hip flexors versus loosey-goosey hip flexors, but maybe, you know, deactivated glutes. So there's some other things to be looked at from that standpoint too. And you may find that one person has really, really strong active glutes and they don't need to do quite as many glute activation exercises in, say, the weight room in their training program versus someone who has, say, like tight hip flexors and inactive glutes who may need to do more squats and lunges and kickouts and clamshells and all these other exercises to keep the glutes turned on. So, yeah, I mean, you know, not to belabor the topic too much, but again, it all comes down to individuality, testing your body, and then programming your training, your nutrition, and your supplementation and recovery accordingly.
Yeah, no, and I think that's good. And I'm glad you mentioned the testing that listeners can go check out, or make sure you get your own test done. And like Ben said, it's, you know, pretty inexpensive to do that, and, you know, could give you a lot of insight into what you need to do in the future and moving forward. And especially with the full body analysis, I know I've talked about this a lot on the podcast, and Ben, I'm sure you wouldn't know, but I did do a full body gait analysis with all those things you mentioned twice, and it's been a life changer for me with my running. So definitely would recommend that too. So when it comes to, let's talk a bit more about fat burning, as that's something a lot of our listeners will be interested in. Maintaining weight is always, you know, important for runners, and I know this is something you've looked into. So could you share some things that you've learned about fat burning efficiency, like how runners can get the most out of their training to make sure they burn as much fat as possible?
Yeah, they actually just this week had a really interesting study where they took endurance athletes and they put them on a low carb intake in the evening, and then they had them sleep fasted, of course, without snacking or anything in the evening. And then they'd get up and they'd exercise in almost like a carbohydrate depleted and fasted state. And what they found in that group of subjects was not only did their fat oxidation increase in terms of the amount of fat that they tapped into during their exercise sessions, but they were able to, on subsequent feedings, maximize the amount of glycogen or storage carbohydrate available to their bodies. This concept, and you could Google this term and you come up with a lot of writing and studies on the subject of training low, racing high.
Yeah.
That's the concept of limiting carbohydrate intake during your training, and then during your race, allowing yourself to feed on carbohydrates as like a pre-workout meal, and also on, you know, gels and powders and things like that during the race, so that your body is basically able to use carbohydrate and store carbohydrate much more efficiently while also burning fat more efficiently. Now, that's one model, this whole train low, race high model. There's another model that's basically training low and racing low. That's something I've experimented with quite a bit. It's more of like a ketosis-based approach where you limit carbohydrates during the year, not because it makes you faster, but because you can perform just as well while decreasing some of the potential deleterious effects of high carbohydrate intake, such as the ability of glucose to adhere to cholesterol particles and make them more atherosclerotic, or the propensity for frequent blood sugar fluctuations to cause neurofibrillary tangles and plaque formation in neural tissue in the brain and accelerate, for example, cognitive decline, or the ability of advanced glycation end products to form in connective tissue and cause things like premature wrinkles and aging. You see this a lot in endurance athletes. And you know, a lot of people will say, well, why would I restrict carbohydrates? They've been shown to help with exercise. And absolutely, they have. They're like a drug. Sugar is like a drug. It can absolutely enhance performance and provide a really fast-burning source of energy. But what I'm saying is, if you could perform just as well by limiting carbohydrates, why not do it? Because you tap into a lot of the health benefits therein. So this would be a scenario where you're not just training low, but you're also, for your big training days and your racing sessions, rather than choosing sugary compounds, you're choosing lower glycemic index or even fat-based compounds. So an example of that would be, prior to a run, rather than mixing powders or juices or gels into your running belt or, you know, your a handheld water bottle or whatever. You are instead using, for example, a little bit of coconut oil, or what's called medium chain triglyceride oil, which is a fat that bypasses digestion and is burnt very efficiently as a fuel, combined with some amino acids, which can help to keep your central nervous system from bonking. High blood levels of amino acids are actually something that can decrease the fatigue that sets in during prolonged endurance efforts. It has to do with those amino acids competing for tryptophan, which is like that sleepy molecule. Yeah. When your muscles break down during exercise, tryptophan crosses your blood-brain barrier and makes you sleepy. But if you can have other amino acids present that are competing for tryptophan, that doesn't happen. So you've got some fats in your bottle or your flask. You've got some amino acids. And then if you're going to do a carbohydrate, you choose like a very slow-release carbohydrate. Like there are some out there like kind of like a complex pea-based starch is one. There's a company called Exos that makes one called Carb Fuel. Very, very slow release carbohydrate. So it doesn't spike your blood sugar levels and it keeps you in a state where you're oxidizing more fat as a fuel. Another example of that would be like you can superstarch, mm-hmm. which is a high molecular weight, non-GMO corn-based starch that again gets very slowly released into your bloodstream to be used as a fuel. The last thing you could even experiment would be something relatively new to the market, but it would be powdered or liquid ketones. I recently wrote an article over at bengreenfieldfitness.com about how to get into ketosis and the benefits that an endurance athlete can derive from high blood levels of ketones. Because a lot of muscles that we use for endurance, like the diaphragm and the heart, for example, primarily rely upon ketones, not glucose, as a fuel. And so you could even add some ketones into the mix as well. Your body will produce its own ketones by breaking down fats, but you can also add even more into the mix if you wanted to. And that would be an example of training low and also racing low, you know, just not doing a lot of carbohydrates in general. Now, the very interesting thing, and I was part of this study a couple years ago, is that if you do follow a higher fat diet and you incorporate some of these concepts like avoiding sugars, choosing slow release carbohydrates, even throwing in like some fasted workouts here and there to train your body how to use fats more efficiently as a fuel, you can achieve some pretty cool things. For example, what physiology textbooks will tell you is that the maximum amount of fat that the body can oxidize is about 1.0 grams of fat per minute, mm-hmm. 1.0 grams of fat per minute. But in a study that I took part in which I and a handful of other endurance athletes followed a low-carb, kind of higher fat, train low, race low type of approach over the course of a year, they took us into a lab and compared us to another group of traditionally fueled endurance athletes and found that we burnt about 1.7 grams of fat on average per minute, meaning literally the fat burning textbooks should be rewritten mm-hmm. and should differentiate between athletes who are following a high carb diet versus a low carb diet, because it looks like higher fat intake, a little bit lower carb intake, some intermittent fasting, some fasted workouts, etc., can actually shift your body into a very efficient state of fat utilization, which comes in quite handy for, you know, for long endurance events, yeah. because you're sparing glycogen, you're enhancing fat utilization, and you're even feeding more ketones into the heart and the diaphragm and the brain, while also limiting some of the potentially deleterious effects of higher glucose intake.
Interesting. And so could you share kind of like a typical day of like eating for you right now, just to kind of show when you say about this high fat diet, low carb, like just how low are you talking? Like is fruit included in the low carb, or are you just talking about like processed carbs? Or
I'm not a huge fan of processed carbs for mm-hmm. for really anybody, whether you're yeah. following a high fat or a high carb diet. You know, I'm a fan of good natural sources of carbohydrates when you do eat them, like sweet potatoes, yeah. yams, rice, quinoa, amaranth, millet, you know. And yeah, fruit, preferably dark fruit like pomegranates, berries, things that are high in antioxidants, flavanols, polyphenols. Got to throw a little bit of red wine and dark chocolate in there, of course. But basically, for me, for example, I do not do the whole thing that like paleo people do with like bacon, eggs, steak, fish high amounts of animal-based fats because those can be inflammatory, mm-hmm. and they're often accompanied by high amounts of protein. And I've done blood testing on like a lot of people who follow this whole kind of paleo diet. They tend to have very high levels of blood glucose and often higher levels of inflammation related to high blood glucose and high intake of protein, because when you get most of your fats from animal-based sources, what happens is you take in a lot of protein along with those fats, and protein is very readily converted into glucose through a process called gluconeogenesis. The mm-hmm. liver can very easily convert proteins into glucose. And there are some other metabolic effects, you know, such as nitrogenous waste products and even metabolic acidity, which can occur with high intake of animal foods and animal meat. So I'm careful. I do have a fish or like grass-fed beef or something like that. I even do some ancestral meats, you know, like liver or, you know, or heart. But it would be at maximum about once a day. Okay. Sometimes it's only once every couple of days that I'll have a, you know, any significant portion of animal meat. And most of the rest of my diet is comprised of a large intake of plants, such as a big kale, spinach, cucumber, cilantro smoothie in the morning for breakfast. And I'll add some good plant-based fats like coconut milk and avocado mm-hmm. and a handful of walnuts and a little bit of almond butter and maybe some dark chocolate powder to something like that. And if it's a training day, I'll even add, you know, protein like a hemp or a pea or a rice-based protein. And in the afternoon for lunch, you know, I'll typically not eat for about 4 or 5 hours after breakfast. And for lunch, I'll have a big salad, you know, maybe some more walnuts or avocado, maybe a little bit of fish on top of that. And then, you know, again, I don't eat a lot until dinner, and dinner might be, you know, that portion of meat I described, like maybe I'd have a little bit of grass-fed beef with roasted vegetables. And the majority of the carbohydrate intake, based off the fact that based on your natural circadian rhythms, you're less sensitive from an insulinogenic standpoint to carbohydrate intake later in the day, especially if you do your main workout later in the day, which is ideal because that's when your body temperature peaks and your reaction time peaks. It's why most records in endurance are beaten right around 4 p.m. in the afternoon. It's just mm-hmm. the ideal time to be exercising. Well, if you move the majority of your day's carbohydrate intake to dinner, that means that the carbohydrates that you take in are more likely to be shuttled into muscle and into liver to be stored away as glycogen and less likely to result in big blood sugar spikes. Mm-hmm. So I eat a lot of plants, eat a lot of healthy fats and healthy oils leading up to dinner. And then with dinner, I'll have, you know, anywhere from 100 up to 200 grams of rice or fruit or red wine or chocolate or, you know, yams or you name it. And as far as snacking goes, typically snacking is really not occurring very much at all during the day, aside from like a pre-workout snack. If it's going to be a big workout, in which case I'll typically stick to fats or amino acids. Like an example would be like 4 ounces of coconut milk for like the medium chain triglycerides and some calories. And I'll stir like some dark chocolate stevia into that, a handful of coconut flakes, and perhaps a scoop or two of like a flavored amino acid blend, like a berry flavored amino acid blend. And so, you know, even my pre-workout afternoon snack really is not spiking blood glucose levels. So that would be an example of a typical day for me. It's just lots of plants, fats, oils, mm-hmm. healthy carbohydrates at the end of the day, and not a lot of snacking.
I find that very interesting that you said about what you found with placing, you know, if you are going to have carbs, placing them at the end of the day, because I almost feel like a lot of the things we read kind of say that we shouldn't really do that. Like we should have, you know, the majority of your carbs at the beginning of the day, because then your body is, you know, going to work them off as the day goes on. And so yeah. I'm interested that you said that you kind of do it the other way around. And I mean, that's, I love hearing that because that's kind of actually pretty similar to what I do. But
And you know, people will do a morning workout, like their main workout of the day will be in the morning, and they'll mm-hmm. say, well, should I just shift that? Should I have my carbohydrates after that workout so that I more efficiently shuttle the carbohydrates into the muscle for restoration? There are two thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. Number one, and I have a very interesting interview with a really good scientist named John Kiefer on my podcast somewhere. If you go do a search for me and him, you'll find a good interview between us where we talk about the research that does indeed show that it's later in the day when your insulinogenic response to carbohydrates is less pronounced, especially if you're doing your workout at the end of the day, but even if you're not. And so that's one thing to bear in mind, is that there's a difference between what science tells us and what common sense might say, right? Like, eat your carbohydrates at the beginning of the day. Turns out end of the day is better. The other thing is that if you're looking at this from a recovery standpoint, by eating ad libitum, according to appetite, during the day from the protein, fat, and carb sources that you take in during the day. And remember, your body can make carbohydrates from protein, can also make carbohydrates from the glycerol backbone of fats. Less insulin spiking from fats than from proteins, but your body can actually make carbohydrate precursors from both proteins and fats. Basically, the idea is that over the course of 8 hours following a workout, your body naturally replenishes the liver and muscle glycogen stores lost during that workout. And so the only situation in which you would need to prioritize carbohydrates after a morning workout is if you were going to work out again within 8 hours after that morning workout. So if you are indeed someone who finishes a workout at, say, 7 a.m. in the morning, and then let's say you you hit the gym at 3 p.m., it may indeed behoove you to take in about 50 to 100 grams of carbohydrate with breakfast. If you're a two-a-day person who's doing especially like two draining efforts during the day. But that's, you know, there's some people that fall into that category, more serious athletes. But even myself, you know, I'm a somewhat serious athlete, but my morning workout is always very parasympathetic nervous system based, meaning it's usually like yoga or an easy walk, sometimes an easy swim, an easy things that don't really tap into glycogen that much anyways, that are more fat burning based. And so even for me, I do a morning workout and I do a two-a-day in which I'm often exercising again less than 8 hours from that morning workout. But because my morning workout is not exhausting a bunch of glycogen stores, I still don't include a lot of carbohydrates with that morning meal, if any. So that's kind of how that works.
So then when it comes to, you mentioned about what you just said about the various having carbs more towards the end of the day, even if you work out in the morning, what would you say is a good source of fuel for someone after a workout if they do, they are that person, like you mentioned about the 7 a.m. finish?
Not fructose, not fruit, unfortunately, even though it tastes so good for breakfast. It doesn't do a very good job at replenishing muscle glycogen. It does a pretty decent job at replenishing liver glycogen. And so you could do a little bit of it, but a giant fruit smoothie is not best. If you do have anything with breakfast as far as fruit, the equivalent of a piece of fresh raw fruit would be fine. Another example of a good protein source for breakfast would be like some boiled chunks of sweet potato or yam. Okay. That's a good option. That's one that I like. I'm not a huge fan of rice for breakfast, but, you know, for example, like a good bread, like a fermented sourdough bread, for example, because the process of fermentation can deactivate a lot of the digestive issues with bread, like the fact that it contains lots of phytic acid, which can keep you from absorbing minerals and nutrients. But if you eat your bread from a fermented source, you know, I'm a huge fan of fermented sourdough. You know, maybe you like to have like some toast for breakfast with some eggs and a piece of fruit, that type of thing. So, you know, it'll kind of vary based on your tastes and preferences, but please know that in addition to any fructose sources you may be taking in, you still need something like a potato-based source or a bread-based source to satisfy the muscle glycogen needs. Okay. Because the muscle lacks the enzyme necessary for using fructose to create storage glycogen. Only the liver has that enzyme, so you have to take care of your muscles too.
Some days, we need all the motivation we can get to make sure we finish our workout or make it through that cross-training session, especially when we're trapped indoors. It has been well documented that running with music or a motivating podcast can help improve performance. But as much as I love the idea, I found myself getting frustrated with the cords getting in my way, or when they would rip out of the treadmill. Finally, I have a solution. Jabra Pulse is a sweat-proof, weatherproof, wireless sports earbud that is perfect for runners of all levels and speeds. Even better, it has an accurate in-ear heart rate monitor that quickly connects to your phone so you can ditch the chest strap. The earbuds will have a secure and comfortable fit thanks to the ability to customize the earpieces. Runners Connect listeners can get exclusive offers and enter to win a free Jabra Pulse headset by signing up at jabra.com/runnersconnect. That's jabra.com/runnersconnect to start your journey, or buy the Jabra Pulse at your local Best Buy. Jabra, this is where it starts. Okay, great. Thank you so much. And okay, we've just got a few more little questions, which are very short and quick, in our final kick section, which is, okay, first one is, what is your greatest greatest advice you've ever been told?
I'm not somebody who's ever really had many mentors or many folks giving me advice, but I would say probably the advice that a good plan today is better than a perfect plan tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's helped me a lot of times. You know, it's like when you walk into the gym or you start a workout, it's like, oh, I don't have the perfect workout plan. Just do something, right? Mm-hmm. Do something. And, you know, a lot of times that will suffice. And in both, you know, business and in exercise, you know, I'm a fan of just, you know, making things happen, even if it's not perfect. Just, you know, as a good author named Seth Godin says, you know, just ship your product.
Yeah.
You know, get it out to people, get feedback, fix it as you go. So
yeah, great. That's good advice. Yeah. Your favorite running book or blog other than your own website?
I didn't care for Born to Run too much, but I absolutely loved Christopher McDougall's second book and the sequel to that book called Natural Born Heroes, mm-hmm. about a tribe of super athletes who basically halt the Nazi invasion into Russia by using things like parkour, free running, bodyweight training, hand-to-hand combat, etc., to fight off the Nazis on this little Greek island. It's a fascinating read. And I had Christopher on my podcast to talk about that book. And it's called Natural Born Heroes. That's one of my favorites in the running world.
Yeah, no, definitely. I also interviewed him and read the book and loved it as well. So that's another recommendation. And I'll put a link on the show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC94. Okay, what is your favorite pre-race meal? I think you've already mentioned that. Is that what you mentioned earlier with the coconut oil and aminos?
My favorite pre-race meal will depend. If it is a very glycolytically demanding race with many surges during the race, mm-hmm. and many anaerobic efforts, it'll be like a sweet potato or yam or two with a little bit of raw honey and some almond butter and some sea salt, something like that.
Okay.
If it's just like a long aerobic effort that doesn't require a lot of surges, a lot of match burning, I'm actually a fan of, even though I don't use this approach all the time, that the whole like bulletproof coffee thing where you have some coffee with some butter, some MCT oil, stuff like that. And the reason I'd go for that versus like a higher fat, you know, like the smoothie I described earlier, is because all that fiber can sometimes mess with you during a race. So yeah, for the past couple of Ironman triathlons I've done, I've just used like the giant cup of coffee blended up with a little bit of butter, a little bit of MCT oil or coconut oil, and some coconut milk, you know, sweetened with some stevia. And that gives you a nice slow release of fats. And also it causes the terpenes that are in the coffee, the psychologically active terpenes that you normally wouldn't feel, once they're bound up to fats, they cross the blood-brain barrier and you get a very long high from that morning cup of coffee pre-race. So I'm a fan of that approach. Again, assuming it's not a race that has a lot of glycolytic surges in it.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing. Okay, just two short little ones left. What would your best advice be to a new runner?
Train consistently. Mm-hmm. Don't necessarily look at training as specific like blocks, like weekend blocks, et cetera. I'm a big fan of, for new runners, basically doing something every day, being extremely consistent with shorter sessions rather than hitting it every 2 or 3 days with longer sessions. So consistency, consistency, consistency.
Yep.
Plan it out on Sunday night, every single session you're going to do the rest of the week, and make them small and palatable. It's a good way to progress your fitness without injury.
Definitely. And I think that helps with getting in a habit of doing it rather than kind of, it's easy to kind of skip when you have days in between. And finally, your favorite running product. I mean, you're walking on a Trueform treadmill, so I wonder if that is it, but is there something else?
I do like this Trueform treadmill. There's something else lying on the floor beside me I've been using quite a bit of recently. And I don't know if you've seen these e-grips. You hold one in each hand while you're running, almost like a baton, but a little bit more biomechanically favorable. And believe it or not, when you clench and you hold something while you run, it helps you bring your hips into proper alignment and it activates your glutes. And considering that these true form treadmills kind of make it impossible to run without a mid to front forefoot strike and glute activation, I've been doing a 1-2 combo where I'll do a series of, for example, 10 sprints for about 30 seconds each, just focusing on 100% absolutely perfect form, both holding these e-grips and running on the true form. And my running biomechanics have really been coming along by doing that. I feel very sound when I go out for longer outdoor treks. It's really helped my biomechanics. So they're called e-grips. You could probably find them on Amazon, for example.
Okay, yeah, and I'll put a link to those in the show notes. Okay, great. Well, Ben, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy, so we are very grateful you managed to squeeze us in. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to following what you're up to in the future.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, Tina. I appreciate it. I'm honored. And if anybody has questions, you can always shoot them over to me. And thanks, everybody, for listening in.
Great. Thank you. Believe it or not, Ben was walking on his Trueform treadmill the entire interview. Now that's committed. Ben is so knowledgeable and someone I've always looked up to with the popularity of his podcast and business. Hopefully you enjoyed hearing the tidbits he shared as much as I did. If you enjoyed the podcast today, I would love if you could subscribe, which you can do so by visiting our podcast page at runnersconnect.net/run-to-the-top. If you have anyone in particular you would like to hear from on the podcast in the future, please feel free to email me, tina@runnersconnect.net. I would love to hear from you. Next week, we'll have Ben's good friend, Tawny Prazak, who is the host of Endurance Planet. I know many of you are excited to hear from her, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's have a great week.